KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
It feels like being punched in the gut. It's just outrageous.
The Women's Health Initiative collected groundbreaking research on health habits of tens of thousands of women.
Now the Trump administration is shutting down much of the project.
For Wednesday, April 23rd, this is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. This hour to Nova Scotia, where we meet a group of lobster fishermen.
They're concerned about the impact of President Trump's sweeping tariffs.
Lobster industry drives everything in this community. If you take the prices away, you take the lobster away, you take the whole economy away. It would be crippling.
And the Catholic Church will soon select a new pope.
How did the conclave get its name?
It comes from two words, cum clavi, which means with a key. And they formed the noun conclave.
Those stories coming up in this hour of All Things Considered after the newscast.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. The latest round of talks over a future peace plan for Ukraine should have taken place today in London, but discussions were pared back sharply as American patience with Ukraine and Europe appears to be running short. More from Villa Marks.
After U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio pulled out of the meeting at the last minute, it threw the status of a possible framework for negotiations between Kiev and Moscow into doubt. Rubio's no-show meant British Foreign Minister David Lammy cancelled meetings with his French and German counterparts, talking instead with Ukraine's Foreign Minister and Defense Minister. As President Trump's special envoy Steve Witkoff travels to Moscow this week, the obstacles to a peace agreement that the Ukrainians will accept may now extend beyond Russian missiles to the White House itself. That's because Trump is pressing President Zelensky to accept that territory seized in Russia's invasion and Crimea could permanently remain in Moscow's hands, something Kiev has repeatedly rejected. For NPR News, I'm Willem Marx in London.
There are reports tonight of injuries in Kyiv following a drone and missile strike. The president of the Palestinian Authority has called on the militant group Hamas to disarm and hand over responsibility for Gaza to his administration. NPR's Jane Arraf reports from Amman.
Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas was speaking in the West Bank capital, Ramallah. Hamas and Abbas's party, which dominates the Palestinian Authority, governing part of the Israeli-occupied West Bank, have long been rivals. Abbas blamed Hamas for giving Israel a pretext to destroy Gaza and said Hamas should release Israeli hostages. Israel has tried to destroy Hamas throughout the war in Gaza and has also said it would not accept any role for the Palestinian Authority. Abbas, who is 89, has been under pressure to step down. He's expected to appoint a successor this week. Jane Arraf, NPR News, Amman.
In Manhattan, prosecutors and defense teams have made their opening arguments in the sex abuse trial of disgraced film executive Harvey Weinstein. Ilya Meritz has details.
Manhattan Assistant District Attorney Shannon Lucy told the jury about three women who will testify against Weinstein. All three were young when they met him. All three will describe Weinstein bringing them to hotel rooms, where he allegedly sexually abused them and, in one case, allegedly committed rape. The women stayed silent for years, she said, because of Weinstein's clout. Defense attorney Arthur Idala said what Weinstein had with the women was more like a friends with benefits relationship. He said the three accusers' accounts do not add up, and he called them manipulative and conniving. This is Weinstein's second New York trial. An earlier conviction for sex crimes was overturned on procedural grounds last year. For NPR News, I'm Ilya Meritz in New York.
Global markets appear to be rising after President Trump has backed off somewhat on his threats to fire Fed Chair Jerome Powell and implement tariffs. The Dow was up 419 points today. You're listening to NPR News. The National Institutes of Health plans to include private health information in a study of rising rates of autism spectrum disorder. NPR's John Hamilton reports the study is part of a larger federal effort to find the causes of autism.
NIH Director Jay Bhattacharya says the agency will create a national database of autistic people, then look for factors that might have contributed to their diagnosis. The effort will use data from private doctors and insurance companies, as well as government health programs. One goal is to identify environmental exposures that could cause autism. But Dr. David Mandel of the University of Pennsylvania says that's unlikely.
The exposure is probably in utero, and it looks like we're studying children after they're born.
There's also concern that sensitive private information used in the study could become public. John Hamilton, NPR News.
This year's winner of the $50 million X Prize is a company that puts crushed rock on farmers' fields to draw climate-warming carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. The X Prize, offered by Tesla CEO Elon Musk's foundation, going to U.S.-based Mati Carbon, which has been using the technology to help farmers in India. Mati Carbon is among the 1,300 teams from 88 countries that took part in this year's carbon removal competition. Officials say several other teams also removed 1,000 tons of carbon dioxide in the past year. Crude oil futures prices after yesterday's run-up moved sharply in the opposite direction today after sources said OPEC might be considering accelerating oil output. Oil down $1.99 a barrel to $61.68 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Subaru. In partnership with the Arbor Day Foundation, Subaru is distributing over 100,000 trees this year to grow greener, healthier communities for generations to come. Subaru, more than a car company.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro in Culver City, California.
And I'm Juana Summers in Washington. The Trump administration is shutting down the bulk of a long-standing federal project studying women's health. The project is the first of its kind and collected groundbreaking research on the health habits of tens of thousands of women. NPR health correspondent Rob Stein is here with the latest. Hi, Rob.
Hey, Juana.
Rob, start if you can by just reminding us what the Women's Health Initiative is all about.
Yes, so the National Institutes of Health launched the Women's Health Initiative in the 1990s, and the idea was that most medical research had been conducted about men, so this was an attempt to correct that long-standing disparity. Scientists at dozens of research centers around the country started collecting detailed information about more than 160,000 middle-aged and older women. You know, stuff like, what do they eat? How much exercise do they get? What medications do they take? What illnesses do they get?
What are some of the study's important findings?
Probably the most well-known was the recognition that taking hormones starting during menopause does not protect a woman's heart, which had been the medical dogma for years. In fact, the study found that long-term hormone use could be risky. But that wasn't all. The initiative also produced groundbreaking findings about whether taking supplements like vitamin D and calcium can decrease the risk for osteoporosis. The study found the supplements didn't help. Here's Marion Neuhauser at the Fred Hutch Cancer Center in Seattle. She leads the project steering committee.
Women have been neglected, and women affect everyone. So someone's mother, grandmother, sister, friend, neighbor. It's a landmark study, and to cease the funding, it is a huge loss. I can't put it in words what a huge loss it is.
Now, the study hasn't been perfect. The initial findings about hormones produced a lot of anxiety and confusion, but most experts say the project helped clarify that and answer many other really important questions about women's health.
Okay, got it. So what exactly, Rob, has the Trump administration announced about the Women's Health Initiative?
Neuhauser says that HHS, which oversees the NIH, notified the project's four regional centers in California, New York, Ohio, and North Carolina that their contracts for collecting data will be terminated in September. Each contract was for about $1 million a year. That means researchers will cease collecting any new data from more than 40,000 women who are still in the study. It appears to be part of a huge cut in contracts the Trump administration is demanding from all federal health agencies. Scientists say that the decision is ill-conceived because it cuts off crucial research at a time when the nation is aging. I talked about this with Marcia Stefanik, who runs the initiative's Western Regional Center at Stanford University in California.
We're all shocked. It feels like being punched in the gut. It's just outrageous. It's such an important study. It's devastating. It just feels terrible.
Stefanik and others say the Women's Health Initiative is uniquely positioned to study what the new administration says is a top priority, fighting chronic diseases, you know, like Alzheimer's.
Yeah, so Rob, tell us what happens from here.
The researchers are starting to notify the now older women in the study that they will have to stop following them and can't continue building on what they've learned by following them for so long now. And one big question is, what's going to happen to the only part of the study that would be left, the coordinating center in Seattle? No one from HHS or NIH responded to my questions, but the project says the coordinating center's funding will continue through January. After that, no one knows. So what will happen to the huge repository of data, including blood samples and genetic material, which is a treasure trove that could be mined to make yet more important discoveries about women's health?
That is NPR health correspondent Rob Stein. Rob, thank you.
You bet.
Elon Musk says he'll pull back from his work in the Trump administration to focus on running his electric car business, Tesla. For the last few months, Musk has had massive access and power within the White House. NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben reports on the relationship that was mutually beneficial until things got complicated.
On election night, Donald Trump gave special attention to one of his biggest supporters.
Oh, let me tell you, we have a new star. A star is born, Elon.
Their political courtship was only a few months old. Musk endorsed Trump shortly after the July assassination attempt in Butler, Pennsylvania. Musk later explained his attraction at another Trump rally in Butler in October.
We had one president who couldn't climb a flight of stairs and another who was fist pumping after getting shot. Fight, fight, fight. Blood coming down the face.
Musk would go on to spend $250 million supporting Trump and other Republicans in the 2024 election. By the time Musk took the stage at Trump's October Madison Square Garden rally, Trump had already said Musk would lead a project they called the Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE. Howard Lutnick, who is now Commerce Secretary, introduced Musk.
How much do you think we can rip out of this wasted $6.5 trillion Harris-Biden budget?
Well, I think we can do at least $2
trillion. Yeah!
Musk brought a chaotic energy to his new political role. He grabbed headlines when he twice made a straight-armed gesture that resembled a Nazi salute at Trump's inauguration. Musk denied that, then joked about it on social media. Once Trump took office, Musk was everywhere, riding on Air Force One and taking questions with the president in the Oval Office, once with his four-year-old son in tow. Trump was generous with Musk, constantly praising him and letting him speak at length, even at cabinet meetings. At the first one, Trump jokingly chided Musk at one point.
Hey, Elon, let the cabinet speak just for a second.
At DOGE, Musk had almost unrestricted ability to look at the details of agencies that oversaw his businesses, companies that do a lot of work for the federal government. He gleefully set to work reshaping the bureaucracy he railed against as a businessman, even brandishing a chainsaw on stage at a conservative conference earlier this year.
This is the chainsaw for bureaucracy. Chainsaw!
Under Musk, DOGE has effectively dismantled some agencies and left others reeling after slashing tens of thousands of jobs. But big savings have been hard to find. On the campaign trail, Musk had said he was shooting for $2 trillion. But by a cabinet meeting earlier this month, the goal was much smaller.
I'm excited to announce that we anticipate savings in FY26 from reduction of waste and fraud by $150 billion.
Courts have halted many of DOGE's actions, including attempts to obtain access to sensitive data. By spring, Trump was saying that cabinet members would be taking more of the lead in making decisions about their agencies.
Hundreds of billions of dollars of waste and fraud and abuse has been found, already found. And that doesn't mean they don't have a little bit of an argument here and there about something, or maybe personnel arguments.
There were also signs Musk was becoming a political liability. He spent and campaigned heavily for the conservative in a Wisconsin Supreme Court election in April, who then lost. Meanwhile, widespread Tesla takedown protests were happening at dealerships nationwide.
Oh, oh, Elon Musk has got to go.
Musk openly disagreed with Trump's tariff policy, at one point calling trade advisor Peter Navarro dumber than a sack of bricks. Musk's job at DOGE was always supposed to be a temporary assignment. Recently, Trump has been vague about Musk's future, but complimentary as always.
Well, I think he's amazing, but I also think he's got a big company to run, and so at some point he's going to be going back. He wants to.
Would you want to keep him around?
I'd keep him as long as I could keep him. He's a very talented guy.
This week, Tesla reported dismal earnings, and Musk announced to shareholders that he would be paring back his role at DOGE. The White House has not responded to NPR's questions about how much Musk will be scaling back. Danielle Kurtzleben, NPR News.
The death of Pope Francis on Monday means the Catholic Church will soon begin the process of selecting a new pope, but the public won't get to see behind the closed doors of the Sistine Chapel. NPR's Joe Hernandez reports on how the conclave got its name and why it's been secretive for so long.
The word conclave did not start with the Catholic Church. In fact, its Latin roots date back to ancient Rome, before Jesus was even born.
It comes from two words, cum clavi, which means with a key, and they formed the noun conclave.
Anthony Labello, author of Origins of Catholic Words, says the word initially referred to a room that could be locked shut. It wasn't until centuries later that conclave was used to describe the election of a pope.
In the Middle Ages, the institution of locking the cardinals up was introduced, and so the word was ready-made for that.
In 1274, Pope Gregory X put in place some new rules for future papal elections, including keeping the proceedings secret from the public. Miles Pattenden, an Oxford University history professor who studies the Catholic Church, says the theological idea underpinning the conclave is that God, through the Holy Spirit, comes down and helps inspire the cardinal's choice.
And in order for that to happen and for it to be believed and believable, the cardinals have to be separated away from everybody else while they're making this decision.
There were other reasons to keep the conclave secret. It protected the election from outside meddling and helped keep the cardinals focused. But being locked away had its challenges. A big one, personal hygiene.
From some of my research on the 16th and 17th centuries, I found all kinds of reference to how disgusting it was being inside there, how badly the place smelled, how susceptible it was to disease, especially if the conclave was taking place in summer.
In 1996, Pope John Paul II decided that cardinal electors would no longer have to stay in the Sistine Chapel during the entire conclave and could spend their evenings in a nearby Vatican guesthouse. But even today, papal conclaves remain highly secretive. The only signal the public will get from inside the closed-door meeting is the smoke that billows from the Sistine Chapel's chimney, black if there's no winner yet, and white if there is. Joe Hernandez, NPR News.
Thank you for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Thank you.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from your part-time controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists, providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. President Trump's tariffs are being felt in just about every part of the world, including Canada. Tariffs have impacted the country's entire economy against the backdrop of a competitive federal election. NPR's Jackie Northam met a group of lobster fishermen in Nova Scotia to find out how the sweeping tariffs are affecting their industry and the country's politics.
When the weather turns nasty, lobster fishermen here in Clark's Harbor, off the southwestern tip of Nova Scotia, gather at what they call the barn to chat over coffee and play cards. There's no use going out in weather like this.
Too rough. Seas is too big. When the weight get high, lobsters will not move. You just waste a time.
The barn belongs to Marty Atwood. He's been a lobster fisherman for more than three decades. He spends slow days like this building new lobster traps.
When I'm not fishing, I'm in here building stuff to go fishing.
Atwood grew up in Clark's Harbor. This town of about 800 people would seem to be far removed from the turmoil of President Trump's tariffs. But lobsters were among the goods to be hit with 25% tax when Trump announced his first round of tariffs on Canada in February. Atwood said it was a huge concern.
Right now, lobster industry drives everything in this community. If you take the prices away, you take the lobster away, you take the whole economy away. It would be crippling.
Trump later reversed the decision, excluding any products like lobsters that fall under an existing free trade agreement. But he has kept levies on things like aluminum, steel, and energy. Atwood's father, Russell, fears lobsters could get hit again because he says Trump is erratic.
He always got this in the back of his mind. What day does he have to get up and has a bad day and says, I'm putting 25% tariff on it. So yes, it's a big worry.
Canada's lobster industry was already facing 25% tariffs by China in retaliation for Ottawa placing levies on Chinese electric vehicles. A U.S. tariff would force Canadian lobster companies to dramatically change their business.
This is where we store the lobsters.
Sean Sears, the owner of W. Sears Seafoods, reaches into a large tank of bubbling cold water and pulls out a glistening lobster, its claws held tight with a thick rubber band.
Oh, that one's like a 2.5-pounder, so not a real big one. The smaller lobsters are actually better eating.
At high season, Sears tanks hold about 250,000 pounds of fresh lobster. He ships them to companies in the U.S. It's a highly integrated industry, and both sides would have to pay taxes if Trump reimposes tariffs and Canada retaliates. Sears said he would have to look for new customers.
Different parts of Asia, the Middle East, Saudi Arabia, and just try to expand the domestic market.
The uncertainty and worry here in Clark's Harbor is a microcosm of how tariffs are playing out across the rest of Canada. 160 miles further east along the coast, in Nova Scotia's capital, Halifax, Trump's tariffs were met with disbelief, anger, and resentment.
One firm in particular, over a weekend, believed they lost around $25 million worth of business and were facing layoffs of about 170 people.
Mayor Andy Fillmore says the economic punch was immediate.
Just from the whisper of this possibility, it changed the business dynamics. People lost confidence, contracts went away.
Fillmore says many people in Nova Scotia have close relations with the U.S., and that's what hurt.
This seemed like friends and family giving us a swat on the nose, completely unexpected and quite shocking, eye-wateringly shocking.
But it's more than just the tariffs. There was Trump's threat to turn Canada into the 51st state and making fun of then Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. Out of that sprang a nationwide movement to avoid buying American products. Canadians are canceling trips south of the border, and there's a resurgence of national pride in Canada.
We are a good neighbor who will still be there for our big brother. But we don't need you anymore, America.
A steady rain outside of Halifax didn't deter people at a recent elbows up rally. That's a hockey term, now a popular catchphrase meaning ready to fight. On stage, comedian Sean Majumdar, who recently moved back to Canada after 20 years in Los Angeles, didn't hold back.
We should ghost America for a little.
Those who braved the rain came out to make a point, like Maggie Simpson.
Like many people here, just feeling of wanting to stand in solidarity for Canada's sovereignty and the things that we believe in.
But with an increasing independence comes a recognition that Canada has leaned too heavily on the U.S. for its security.
We've been very fortunate to be one of the most geographically secure countries in the world, and now we find ourselves as being the most geographically vulnerable.
Robert Hewish is a professor of social sciences at Dalhousie University in Halifax.
It's not just Donald Trump is saying, oh, that border is should be redrawn. It's also recognizing we are quite vulnerable in the Arctic to Russian aggression. So we do have work to do there for sure.
Back at the barn in Clark's Harbor, fisherman Marty Atwood is feeling philosophical about Trump's tariffs as he repairs his lobster pots.
We're kind of in this area, take things as they come, so we'll cross that bridge when we get to it.
As will Canada's next prime minister. The federal election is on Monday, and whoever wins will have to wrangle Trump and his unpredictable tariff policy. Jackie Northam, NPR News, Clark's Harbor, Nova Scotia.
India is blaming Pakistan for an attack in which gunmen killed 26 men, mostly Hindu tourists in disputed Kashmir. As NPR's Dia Hadid reports, Pakistan denies responsibility while India has suspended a decades-old water treaty.
Soldiers patrolled roads and streets in Indian-controlled Kashmir. They searched cars as helicopters patrolled the skies, in footage shared by Indian media. It came after gunmen shot dead 26 men in a meadow, mostly Hindu tourists. Eyewitnesses say the gunmen asked the men if they were Muslims before killing them. They also said some Muslim residents helped survivors flee to safety. India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi cut short a foreign trip and vowed those behind the attack would be brought to justice. Then the Foreign Secretary Vikram Misri announced India's water treaty with Pakistan was suspended.
Until Pakistan credibly and irrevocably abjures its support for cross-border terrorism.
That treaty divides six major rivers between India and Pakistan, and it's lasted despite decades of strife and wars over Kashmir. India also expelled military advisers in the Pakistani embassy in New Delhi.
They have a week to leave India.
India pointed the finger at Pakistan after a group called the Resistance Front claimed the attack. India considers it a proxy for militants backed by Pakistan's army. Pakistan says it has no connection to the attack. Its deputy prime minister says the country's National Security Committee will soon convene. Many Kashmiri Muslims have long opposed India's heavy-handed rule, which human rights groups say includes widespread arrests, torture, and killings. Sushant Singh, a lecturer in South Asian studies at Yale and a former Indian military officer, told NPR that while there was a religious element to this attack,
this is about grievances that have been bred for too long. This is about the way the Indian state has conducted itself.
He says those factors, alongside a desire among militants to spread terror, have created this situation. A situation which observers say may well escalate further. Dia Hadid, NPR News, Mumbai.
This is NPR News.
Residents of a South Texas town are voting on a drastic new measure recognizing SpaceX rocket launch site as an actual city. So how do locals feel about it?
My vote's not going to count. It's not going to matter. Starbase is going to happen, as far as I'm concerned.
The battle for Boca Chica Beach on the next morning edition from NPR News.
That's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Natalia Lafourcade wanted to let go of perfectionism. So for her latest album, she gathered all the musicians in a room for one session recorded on analog.
There will be mistakes, but as long as we all are connected, it will be a collective creation.
First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. A federal judge today appeared skeptical of President Trump's executive order targeting the law firm Perkins Coie. The firm is one of four that has sued after being targeted by presidential executive action. NPR's Ryan Lucas has more.
U.S. District Judge Beryl Howell spent 2 hours grilling a Justice Department attorney over the executive order against Perkins Coie. Trump's order takes several punitive steps, including suspending security clearances for the firm's employees and barring its attorneys' access to government officials and buildings. Judge Howell last month temporarily blocked enforcement of aspects of the order. At this hearing, she pressed the Justice Department for details on the deals that other law firms have struck with the president to avoid punishment, as well as legal basis for targeting Perkins Coie for embracing diversity and inclusion in its hiring. At a separate hearing in the same courthouse, another federal judge heard arguments from the law firm WilmerHale that also has sued over a similar executive order targeting it. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, Washington.
Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent says President Trump won't reduce the 145% tariffs he imposed on China unless there's an agreement by both sides to de-escalate their trade conflict that's unsettled world markets. And he says there is an opportunity for a big deal on trade between China and the U.S.
The status quo of large and persistent imbalances is not sustainable. It is not sustainable for the United States. And ultimately, it is not sustainable for other economies.
Speaking there at the Institute of International Finance in Washington, D.C. Now, the news on trade, tariffs, and the Fed sent Wall Street sharply higher today. By the closing bell, the Dow was up 419 points. That's up 1%. The Nasdaq was up 2.5%, gaining 407 points. The S&P 500 up 1.6%, gaining 88 points. This is NPR. A growing number of congressional Democrats in safely blue districts are facing primary challenges from younger candidates. As NPR's Elena Moore reports, driving many of these challengers is a dissatisfaction with the current state of their party.
26-year-old activist and teacher Elijah Manley is running for Congress in Southeast Florida. He's frustrated and says voters are too.
They don't see any urgency to fight back against Donald Trump. I understand that it's not going to be easy, but if we don't even put up a fight, what are we doing?
Though challengers have ousted incumbents of their own party before, strategists say it's nearly impossible. So the Democrats already in office have a significant edge over those seeking to shake up the party and good odds of staying where they are. In the 2024 election, 96% of incumbents held on to seats. Elena Moore, NPR News.
Apple and Meta are each being fined hundreds of millions of dollars by European Union watchdogs over digital anti-competition rules. Apple was cited for preventing app makers from pointing users to cheaper options outside the App Store. Meta was fined because the EU says it forced Facebook and Instagram users to choose between seeing ads or paying to avoid them. The commission says Apple and Meta have to comply with the decision within 60 days or risk unspecified periodic penalty payments. Both companies say they will appeal. You're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station
and from the Nature Conservancy, committed to protecting and preserving the planet during Earth Month and every month through the bold power of local and global action. nature.org/NPR. From Amazon Business, offering business buying services from office supplies to IT essentials and maintenance tools to help bring visions to life. Learn more at amazonbusiness.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers in Washington.
And I'm Ari Shapiro in Culver City, California. A federal judge in Maryland is losing her patience with the Trump administration. U.S. District Judge Paula Zinis accused the administration last night of intentionally flouting her order to answer questions about the illegal deportation of Kilmar Abrego Garcia. And she gave the government a deadline of this evening to provide more details about what it's doing to seek Abrego Garcia's return from El Salvador. NPR's Joel Rose is here with the latest. Joel, how did we get to this latest impasse?
Hi. Three federal courts have now told the Trump administration to seek the return of Abrego Garcia, from Judge Zinis in Maryland all the way up to the Supreme Court, which said the administration should facilitate the release of Abrego Garcia and handle the case as it would if the government had not improperly flown him to El Salvador last month. Zinis ordered daily status updates on the administration's progress, but she found the government's responses vague and unsatisfying, so she then ordered an intense two-week inquiry into what the administration is doing to seek his release.
And what is the White House argument for not bringing him back as the Supreme Court has ordered?
In court filings, the Justice Department has admitted that he was deported because of a, quote, administrative error. But the White House says he is in the custody of El Salvador, so the courts cannot order his return to the U.S. The White House has also tried to portray Abrego Garcia as a member of the gang MS-13 and as a danger to the public. But as Judge Zinis notes, they've offered no proof of that in court. Abrego Garcia has no criminal record. He originally did enter the U.S. illegally, but an immigration judge in 2019 granted him a form of protection that should have prevented his deportation to El Salvador. Since then, he has been living quietly in Maryland with his wife and their three children until he was arrested by ICE last month and flown to El Salvador.
Okay, so the judge has once again ordered the administration to answer questions in a process known as discovery. What's been the response?
The Justice Department responded with more stonewalling. Lawyers for Abrego Garcia wrote to the judge yesterday complaining that the DOJ had produced nothing of substance. Several times, the Justice Department refused to answer questions, saying they were based on the, quote, false premise that the government had been ordered to facilitate Abrego Garcia's release from custody. Although, to be clear, that is exactly what the Supreme Court said. Judge Zinis blasted the DOJ for that mischaracterization. In a scathing order last night, Zinis accused the Justice Department of, quote, a willful and bad faith refusal to comply with discovery obligations. She rejected as specious the government's argument that providing more information would risk revealing state secrets. And she said the administration has been hiding behind, quote, vague and unsubstantiated claims of privilege to evade her orders. And she said, quote, that ends now.
If the judge keeps saying, you can't keep stonewalling me, and the administration keeps stonewalling, where does this go?
Judge Zinis has given the Trump administration a deadline of this evening to provide more detailed answers, including who authorized Abrego Garcia's initial placement in a Salvadoran megaprison and what evidence the Trump administration has that he is a member of MS-13. We also know that lawyers for Abrego Garcia were scheduled to depose two Trump administration officials this week. But we seem to be moving closer and closer to open defiance of the courts. And it is not just this case. This is very similar to what we're seeing in another deportation case involving more than 100 Venezuelan migrants who were flown to El Salvador under a wartime power known as the Alien Enemies Act, without a chance to contest the allegation that they are gang members. The judge in that case has threatened the Trump administration with criminal contempt proceedings, although that is temporarily on hold. And it seems likely that we are headed in the same direction in the Abrego Garcia case now as well.
NPR's Joel Rose, thank you.
You're welcome.
When lawmakers return from recess next week, they will face the daunting task of crafting a sweeping plan to turn the heart of President Trump's domestic agenda into law. It will be a crucial test for House Speaker Mike Johnson, who in his first 100 days this Congress faced an unrelenting wave of challenges. NPR congressional correspondent Claudia Grisales has more.
House Speaker Mike Johnson has spent plenty of time on the knife's edge of political defeat.
After a recent setback on a high-stakes vote, he had a message for his skeptics.
This House Republican majority has delivered over and over and over, and we will again. Don't doubt us. Just give us a little space to do our work, and that's what we'll do.
In 2023, Johnson came into the role a virtual unknown to lead a razor-thin majority. He faced an unruly conference that continues to test his leadership. Earlier this month, fiscal hawks derailed a GOP budget plan, and that came days after Johnson shut down the House floor in a standoff with one Republican member.
Leadership is not doing the right thing. They're not being honest brokers. So I'm not backing down.
That's Florida Congresswoman Ana Paulina Luna in a fierce battle with Johnson to allow members who are new parents to vote by proxy. Former interim speaker Patrick McHenry says it's part and parcel for one of the toughest jobs in Washington.
Everything is public. There are no private conversations. Everything is out in the open.
That's especially true in President Trump's Washington. But more recently, Johnson has kept intra-party fights in-house. Days after Luna's battle with Johnson came to a head, they cut a private deal to record some absentee member votes in limited cases.
It's not what we initially had wanted, but it's a step forward in the right direction.
Johnson had found a way out of the thicket. Later that week, he reached a deal with the fiscally conservative House Freedom Caucus to support the blueprint for that GOP plan that's key to Trump's domestic agenda.
I told you not to doubt us. The media always does. The Democrats always do. But we get the job done, and we're really grateful to have had the big victory on the floor just now.
It marked the party's third fiscal legislative win since January, when the conference elected Johnson to his first full term as speaker. On one of those votes in March, there was a rare scene. House Freedom Caucus members approved a government stopgap measure, in some cases for the first time. Maryland Republican Andy Harris, who chairs the group, says Johnson has a keen ability to listen to factions of the conference known as the Five Families.
We've demonstrated now for the third time that we can deliver on the president's agenda, so I think it bodes well for the future in a narrow majority.
That remains to be seen. In exchange for votes on the blueprint for the GOP spending plan, Harris's group was promised bigger savings that could potentially lead to Medicaid cuts in the final bill, a red line for moderate Republicans. Still, House Budget Committee Chairman Jody Arrington argues Johnson has proven he can build the unlikeliest of coalitions.
I don't know anybody that could have traversed the minefield in the House to achieve the things that we've achieved.
Johnson also has a powerful ally in his corner with Trump, who played a key role in his re-election as Speaker. Trump's also put the conference on notice of the wrath they'll face if they defy him. That's helped Johnson acquire political capital he'll need to get his party across the finish line on that ambitious Republican spending plan. Here's McHenry again.
Moving big, complicated bills and winning votes enhances your power, not diminishes it when you're Speaker of the House.
Johnson's political fate could very well be tied to that multi-trillion dollar spending bill, which demands an improbable coalition of factions with dramatically different visions for the country's future. Claudia Grisales, NPR News, The Capitol.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. In Colorado, federal immigration agents had been showing up at courthouses and detaining people for being in the country without legal status. There's a state law against that, and now one Colorado judge has formally ordered federal agents to stop taking people into custody inside and near the courthouses. Colorado Public Radio's Allison Sherry reports.
Judge John Lee is the chief of Colorado's 9th Judicial District, encompassing three counties in the mountains west of the Continental Divide. The workforce here, supporting touristy areas like Aspen, is heavily Latino. Agents from Immigration and Customs Enforcement have been in the county courthouse lately, perusing dockets, and then detaining some of the defendants who show up for criminal proceedings, unrelated to their immigration status. That's a problem, says local district attorney Ben Sollers.
We want to pursue justice on state level cases. We want to protect witnesses and victims and defendants to feel safe at the courthouse.
Defense attorney Claire Noon has witnessed some of the detentions.
The level of mistrust will directly impact the health, safety, and wellness of our community.
Colorado's five-year-old law bans civil detentions in and even around the perimeters of courthouses. There are similar laws in other states, including Illinois and California. State Senator Julie Gonzalez, who authored Colorado's law, is worried federal agents have not been following it.
If the federal government is willing to flout state law, to flout judges' orders in order to try to carry out their mass deportation tactics, the question for me becomes real simple. Who's next?
Judge Neely's order says that ICE detaining people for civil immigration violations, not crimes, causes, quote, anxiety, fear, and confusion in what is often already an emotionally charged environment. And, he says, it can have a chilling effect on the U.S. judicial system. Closer to Denver, Adams County District Attorney Brian Mason has had defendants deported while being tried in criminal cases. Some of them face serious charges. He says that is a miscarriage of justice.
One, it means that any victim in the case does not see justice. Two, it completely undermines our ability to prosecute what may be a larger case.
Judge Neely's order has been in place in the district for about 2 weeks. ICE has, at least so far, obeyed it. The agency declined to comment for this story, but President Trump's border czar, Tom Homan, has said previously that ICE likes taking people into custody in safe areas, and courthouses are inherently that, given everyone goes through security. In Trump's first term, ICE used to honor, quote, safe spaces with immigration enforcement, and that included courthouses. But the administration changed that policy in January. For NPR News, I'm Allison Sherry in Denver.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro.
Cancionera.
Natalia Lafourcade is a singer-songwriter in Mexico with a huge fan base on both sides of the border. Her new album is called Cancionera, which literally means songstress.
Cántame la luna, canta nuestro mar, canta los olores de la soledad.
She told me that to her, the word cancionera has deeper meanings.
Cancionera came to say you can really do whatever you want. Let yourself be true. Sing your true, sing your freedom.
Cancionera, canta, canta libre al viento.
Natalia Lafourcade has released about a dozen albums and EPs in the last couple decades, but she did something special with this one. She gathered all the musicians in a room together and recorded the songs in one long session on analog tape.
And actually, this is miracle. It's an act of fate, and let's go all together. And there will be mistakes, and there will be things that might come. But as long as we all are connected, it will be a collective creation.
Cancionera plays tribute to her roots in traditional Mexican music, especially son jarocho, the musical style of her home state of Veracruz. There are original songs and also some old folk tunes reimagined. There is an old song on this album that you rewrote some lyrics for, La Bruja, the witch.
Yeah.
And originally the lyrics are about she turned me into a pumpkin. And your lyrics say she filled me with flowers.
Yes.
Me agarra la bruja, me lleva pa'l monte. Me mira, me reza, me llena de flores.
And I feel like that term bruja, witch, sorceress, is something that people today maybe own in a way that earlier generations might have been afraid to.
Yes.
Can you tell me about your relationship to this?
Yes, I wanted to bring La Bruja to the context of Cancionera universe, you know, I think Cancionera.
Like a Cancionera is a kind of sorceress, a kind of a witch. You're casting a spell? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, you know, because I have noticed that I am a very mystic person, I must
I got
confess.
That impression.
and I don't know, I am super energetic, you know, and music can give you that, the feeling of, oh, wow, something is happening right now. So just let go your mind, let go your judgment, or whatever you're doing. But if you're creating something, if you're dancing, if you're painting, writing, if you're playing an instrument, music, you turn off that part of your being, so you can let something else comes.
Me agarra la bruja, me lleva al cerrito, me acuesta en la tierra y se queda conmigo.
You have talked about music as building a bridge, connecting people and cultures and experiences. And it feels like the moment we are living in is defined more by walls than by bridges. And so how do you see your role as an artist, specifically as a Mexican artist with a huge US following?
Yes.
Right now in this moment, compared to when you started making music more than 20 years ago?
Yeah. Yeah, my perception is that we must be very careful about this fact and open our eyes, open our hearts, and not being afraid to make a strong connection to other human beings. Because the connections we are making right now mostly is by cellulars or like other kind of technologies that it's okay, but we must not forget that there is a very strong technology, energetic technology, that goes beyond, even beyond that which is like the magic of connection between human beings. And
it goes
really,
back to getting everyone in the room together to make the album
right
at the same time.
That's my point. But I always say, like, if we are lucky, that magic of music is gonna come, and she's gonna be the master, and she's gonna show us how to make one voice all together. We're gonna be all together as if we had many rehearsals. We didn't have any rehearsal, but we are all together and connected.
Well, let's end with something joyous. I think the song Cocos en la Playa is probably the song on this album that feels most like a party.
I love this song, you know. The song is about basically going on holidays and not forgetting to the importance of yeah, like rest and having vacation. The lyrics has a lot of humor. I think it reflects a part of my personality and my humor, but it also reflects the humor of Mexican people. You know, it has a lot of the way we say things. I wrote this song when I was ending a tour, and I was saying, okay, if something happens, I can leave selling Cocos en la Playa.
Well, I think you're past that phase where you might have to fall back. I think you're safe now, but it's still nice to have that dream.
Yes, yes. Now I know that it could be a very safe zone and comfortable.
We all need that fallback of just selling coconuts on the beach.
Yeah.
Natalia Lafourcade, it has been so lovely talking to you. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Her new album is called Cancionera.
Para brillar como el sol en la playa, necesito un poquito de calma, nadar desnuda sobre las olas, cantando cumbia bajo las estrellas, perder el tiempo buscando piedras, soltarlo todo y tomar mis manos. Se terminaron las fotografías, solo se permiten los buenos días. Se terminaron las fotografías, solo se permite decir.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive Insurance with its Name Your Price tool, a way to see coverage options based on a driver's budget. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. From Workday, Workday is an HR and finance platform for forward thinkers, dedicated to propelling organizations, workforces, and industries into the future. Workday, moving business forever forward. From Fisher Investments, Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement.